Okay, good day, everyone. Dan Cassidy here. So for today's conversation, seeing as how we are roughly at the halfway point of the year, we are going to spend some time reflecting on what was an unprecedented and challenging first half of the year, discuss expectations for what the balance of the year might have in store, and of course, hit on some portfolio positioning. So to cover all of these topics, I am fortunate to have on the line with me today Evan Brown. Evan is the head of multi-asset strategy for UBS Asset Management. So, Evan, it's great to be with you this morning and looking forward to our conversation.
Thank you, Dan. It's always great to join the program.
Absolutely. And Evan, I know we have quite a few topics and areas we would like to hit on throughout the course of our conversation this morning. Maybe we can begin with some macro thoughts. As of today, Evan, where do you believe that the U.S. currently is in the economic cycle?
Well, I think we are early cycle. I think the recession is over. Remember that a recession is defined as, you know, the peak to trough in activity, and we've had that trough. We can see from the roaring back of jobs growth here in the U.S. and pick up in a number of economic indicators. We certainly had a severe recession, a very short recession. But thankfully it's now over and we're now into recovery. I mean, we don't anticipate a double dip in the economy. Obviously all of us are aware of second wave risks of the virus, but I think, you know, we'll be able to muddle through that with more targeted approaches to flare-ups as we're seeing around the country right now, as opposed to wide-scale lockdowns. So it's an early cycle economy.
So, Evan, we are just making our way into the second half of 2020 now. It sounds like you feel this recovery will continue. Maybe some thoughts in terms of what labor conditions, what the U.S. consumer will look like as we get deeper into the second half.
Yes, yeah, so I think what we're seeing right now is, in terms of the recovery, is an initial V shape, right? You shut the economy down and then you restart it. You're going to have a sharp decline in economic activity. You're going to have a sharp rebound in economic activity. So it is V shaped right now. The question is, does it continue to be V shaped or does it level out a bit? And our view is that the recovery will level out a bit, that we're not going to see the same vigor in economic activity that we've seen at least over the last couple of months. And we're seeing it in the high frequency data. We track initial jobless claims. Those have kind of leveled out. They came down sharply, but they've leveled out now at a reasonably high pace, 1.5 million a week. Credit card spending is cooling off a bit. Open table reservations, they're fading somewhat in affected states. So we're still recovering, but it will be at a slower pace. As long as the virus is with us and the economy won't be able to recover full speed ahead. And I think when we look at the U.S. versus, say, the rest of the world, I mean, I think we do have to acknowledge that the U.S. response to the virus relative to other countries has been, I'm being polite here, it's been subpar. You know, this is compared to developed economies like most of Europe, Japan, Canada, and some emerging markets as well in Asia. So those economies are going to be able to rebound faster than we will, at least initially. Not just because of the virus situation right now, but because of the public health infrastructure that's been put in place in a number of these areas versus where we are here. We are again having issues with not enough testing. We have no real contact tracing or surveillance. So it's uncomfortable, but it's an uncomfortable reality that we're just not going to be able to, we'll still recover. We're just not going to be able to recover at the same speed that we would like because of an inadequate health response.
Okay, so it does sound like perhaps some encouraging trends, though, to your point, Evan, slow goings here in the U.S. relative to other regions across the globe. So In terms of notable risks, it sounds like the pandemic may remain chief among them, but do you want to get your pecking order, Evan, in terms of the risks that you'll be monitoring most closely throughout the second half?
Yeah, so the pandemic is the obvious one, and it's the one that everyone's aware of, so don't need to go in much more detail about that. But I think the really key risk, and it's a risk for this month, is what happens with fiscal policy. And this can be a downside risk or an upside risk. We could get surprised to the upside, which would be great. I mean, I think everyone looks to the Fed, and what the Fed did in March to support, provide liquidity, to support market functioning as crucial. And it was what the Fed did was absolutely crucial in stabilizing markets. But I think what fiscal policymakers did has been understated in importance. We would not be able to have this recession be so short, and we would not have been able to have a recession that thankfully didn't turn into a depression without a really strong fiscal package, which was Democrats and Republicans teaming up and getting that through the CARES Act in March. So now we're in July, and the virus is still with us, and we have fiscal cliffs coming up. We've had these enhanced unemployment benefits. Those are due to expire at the end of July. We have state and local governments that have really been on the front end of dealing with this virus in our communities, and their budgets are in really bad shape, and we're seeing layoffs. Even as the overall jobs numbers are improving, we're seeing continued layoffs in the state and local government sector, which will accelerate if these state and local governments don't get support from the federal government. So there's an active debate in Congress. I mean, I think people, both sides of the aisle know that something needs to be done. I expect something will be done. You will get a new fiscal package passed in July. But will it be enough? That's the question. And I think anything below $1 trillion worth of support is going to be very disappointing for the economy and for financial markets. We need to be up in the 1.5 to 2 trillion range just to make sure that we're supporting incomes, businesses, and state and local governments to ensure that this economy can keep afloat and keep recovering, even while we're dealing with the ongoing headwinds of the virus. And second, I mean, we can't talk about risk without talking about the election, and there are nuances to this. It matters which side takes the Senate, we should differentiate a little bit between the economy and markets. Say there's a Democratic sweep, I think that will be okay for the economy. It won't be great for U.S. markets. Okay for the economy because you transfer. There's redistribution, you transfer income into the hands of people, lower income people who are more likely to spend it. Infrastructure would certainly be a welcome development. But from the market's point of view, let's not overcomplicate things. Taxes are going up. Corporate taxes are going up. Taxes on capital gains likely going up. And that's likely to be a headwind for U.S. markets if the polls stay this way, then markets are going to increasingly focus on this and the effect it might have on U.S. equities and U.S. credit. So something we're keeping a close eye on as well.
So, Evan, maybe just backtracking to fiscal policy for a moment. I know you just mentioned infrastructure spending, and that has been talked about as a possible tool within that fiscal arena. just given the political climate that we're in today, and we're roughly 4 months out from the election, how likely would you say that infrastructure spend might be incorporated into additional fiscal measures? And on the monetary side of things, it seems pretty clear from the Fed what they will continue to be doing. Is anything else needed from the Fed at this point?
Yeah, so on the first question, infrastructure I don't expect to be in this fiscal package that we get in July. I think it will be something that happens after the election. The reason being that Democrats and Republicans are just too opposed in terms of how they would do it. Democrats want to do direct spending. Republicans want more public and private partnerships. And to be honest, infrastructure, you know, these projects take a long time to complete. And what we need is something that's going to support the economy right now. So that's going to be supporting incomes of individuals, whether it's through expanded unemployment benefits, stimulus checks, and also, you know, supporting state and local governments. So infrastructure is something that we'll have to wait for, but I do have some optimism that we will get something on the infrastructure front after the election, almost regardless of which side wins. I think on the monetary front, I don't think what the Fed does over the next few months is going to be the most important driver. Of course, I've emphasized the fiscal side. We will see some moves by the Fed. So what we're likely to get in September is a more formal shift in their forward guidance. And in other words, delivering an expectation to the market of when they expect to be raising rates again. And I think what we'll probably get is an economic outcome-based guidance. In other words, Fed saying, hey, we're not going to raise interest rates until we are close to full employment, and until we are not only reaching our inflation target of 2%, but reaching it sustainably and perhaps overshooting. And so that's going to send a strong message to the market that interest rates are not going up for a very, very long time. We may also get, you know, more formal and expanded quantitative easing program. There is some chatter about interest rate caps or yield curve control, like we've seen in Japan or in Australia in a more limited sense. I think it's a little premature for that kind of move. It seems from the most recent Fed communications, the minutes, that they're debating the pros and cons of that kind of move. And it doesn't seem like it's anything imminent, but it is in the toolbox in case something goes wrong, the economic environment deteriorates from here. They have something still in the toolbox that they can use to support an easing of financial conditions.
So, Evan, maybe we can switch gears a bit and hit on some asset classes, maybe beginning with risk assets, U.S. equities. You consider valuations where they are today. We have come very far, very fast from where we were back in March and April. And on a going forward basis, you did point out the election as a risk, a lot of runway ahead of us. But given what polls are pointing to today, the economic policies of a Biden White House likely very different from what market participants have grown accustomed to over the past 4 years. So how should investors think about positioning within just giving valuations and quite a few unknowns that lie ahead of us?
Yeah, so I think a lot of people have some discomfort with where valuations are right now. It's pretty remarkable that you have a 17% return year to date in the NASDAQ, given everything that we've gone through. So there's some discomfort there. But at the same time, you know, let's not forget how we started this discussion, which is that we are early cycle, right? And you know, you don't want to be strategically fighting the market with an economy that is growing. Doesn't mean you're not going to have corrections, and we will certainly have corrections, and there may be, you know, it may be related to election risk, it may be related to the fiscal risk I was just going through, or something else. But I think in general, we are at the start of a new bull market, and you want to be invested in that. So what I do think is, when we look at the world, and this was kind of implied in the relative health response across countries, but also an important relation to the election risk here in the U.S. is that investors want to be diversified, right? They want to have exposure to international markets that have that stronger COVID response, that have cheaper markets, that don't necessarily have the incremental political headwinds that we're about to have here in the U.S. And so that's just something to keep in mind, I think, as we go through the coming months.
Maybe on the defensive side of things, Evan, where are you finding value within fixed income assets right now?
So no one likes to buy a treasury yield buy a treasury security with a yield of 60 to 70 basis points, but you're not buying it for the yield. You're buying it for the diversification if something goes wrong. And it's still the case that if something goes wrong, treasuries are going to be there to offer diversification for your portfolio. They may not rally as much as they have in the past, but they're still going to rally when equities go down. So you still want to have exposure to bonds, even in a low yield environment. If you're looking for yield in this lower yielding environment, I mean, there are places for catch up here. The emerging market dollar denominated bonds. This is an area where we're seeing emerging markets around the world cut rates in line with what's happening in developed economies, and there's just a lot more room for catching up in emerging market credit relative to other risky assets, including U.S. credit or European credit. So that is where in fixed income we're looking to add a little bit of income in our portfolios.
What about emerging market equities, Evan?
Yeah, so emerging market equities, I think we're also positive. We just say you want to pick your spots. We have long liked China. We think China's interesting on a number of levels, kind of first in, first out of the coronavirus crisis, but also certainly the contact tracing and surveillance such that any kind of flare-ups from here are likely to be contained such that you don't get a full outbreak. China continues to open up its markets. We all know that there are some pretty exceptional tech companies there that also have cheaper valuations, at least in terms of the earnings outlook, relative to some U.S. tech. And but now we're also seeing a broadening out in China towards finance and real estate and the like, just a recognition that the economy is really starting to improve and that you have a pretty supportive policy environment to keep that going. So China is a place that in broader North Asia, Korea as well, are places where we particularly like in emerging markets. And I think but again, it's best done on a regional way, because you do have areas of emerging markets like Latin America that are heavily challenged by the coronavirus. And so just want to be aware of those discrepancies.
Evan, maybe sticking with the thought of diversification, though, delving into commodities a bit, I want to get your views on gold. And given the kind of volatility that we may very well see over the course of the next 6 months, what kind of role should gold play in a portfolio?
So I do think gold is a diversifier. I mean, I try to stay neutral. It seems gold elicits an emotional reaction from a lot of different people. You have so-called gold bugs, and then you have people who just hate gold. I just think it has a role in a portfolio, in the sense that we are in a very low yielding environment, not just nominal yields, so just the interest rates we can see, but also real yields, which is, you know, the interest rate minus inflation. So if real yields are going down, either because nominal interest rates are going down or because inflation is going up, then there's a very strong negative relationship between those real yields and gold. The more those continue to go down, the more attractive gold becomes. And if we, you know, as we start approaching the effective lower bound, you'll more and more, look to assets, can perform in that kind of environment. It's also, we've seen gold trade well on broadening out of geopolitical risk. Let's not, as much as we can be constructive on China, let's not forget that, U.S.-China tensions are alive and well. And even if this phase one trade deal is likely to hold through the election, there's a bipartisan support for confronting China. And it's not just here in the U.S., it's in the Western world more broadly. And I think we're going to see flare-ups of tension, whether it's sanctions or other things. And so the gold plays a unique role in that it can really run when you get these kind of geopolitical shocks. So it's been kind of slowly grinding higher, as I think folks have been appreciating its diversifying qualities. I would just keep in mind as we add these to our portfolios, it is a very volatile asset typically. So, I wouldn't recommend making it a, you know, huge chunk of a portfolio, but it definitely plays a role as a diversifier for equities and bonds.
Well, Evan, it's been great catching up with you this morning. Really appreciate all of your time and insight and all of the ground that you've covered with us. Maybe before we close out, any final thoughts and or takeaways you would like to leave with us today, maybe in terms of guidance on how to best navigate through volatility that might emerge over the second half of the year?
Sure. So I do, two things on that last point. There will be volatility in the second half of the year. It's definitely, we've had an incredibly volatile first half, but we will likely have a quite volatile second half as well. But I would just say don't forget that we're highly likely to be early cycle in a economy that's growing, even if the pace is slowing down. And so it's not a time to get too cute with your portfolio trading in and out. It's important to stay invested. And of course, it's important to stay well diversified. I mean, I think as we've discussed on U.S. versus international markets, you know, it's been an incredible, last decade was an incredible one for U.S. markets versus the rest of the world. Dollar strengthening, growth stocks over value stocks, all of that. I would just say over long time periods, it's important not to just extrapolate the recent past into the future. I mean, 2010 to 2019, we had a lot of the market behavior I just described, but the decade prior to that was the exact opposite. U.S. stocks were the real underperformers. You know, you had two big drawdowns. You had the collapse of the tech bubble and the financial crisis, and it was really emerging markets outperforming. And so the point here is that, you know, we can't predict the future, but we can build diversified multi-asset portfolios such that whatever happens with the economic environment, political, tax, regulatory environment, which could very well be changing in a significant way here in the U.S., you want to be adequately diversified into different assets and across regions such that, you know, you have some insurance against a big major changes in the risk environment for a particular asset class. And in this case, I'm saying U.S. equities. So maybe I'll just leave it right there.
Okay, well, Evan, again, do appreciate your time, your insight, and your guidance, and for joining us today. And it sounds like a lot lies ahead of us between now and January, so do look forward to remaining in touch and to having some follow-up conversations with you between now and the end of the year.
That would be great, Dan. Thanks. Thanks again. Always enjoy the discussion.
This presentation is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. Neither UBS Financial Services, Inc. nor any of its employees provide tax or legal advice. You should consult with your personal tax or legal advisor regarding your personal circumstances. In providing wealth management services to clients, we offer both investment advisory and brokerage services, which are separate and distinct and differ in material ways. For information, including the different laws and contracts that govern, visit UBS.com/working with us. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG, member FINRA, SIPC.